Welcome to the Writer's Room, where the funny writers who sit in funny rooms and write funny stuff for other people finally get to talk. Here's your host, Emmy-winning writer and comedian, Jeff Cesario.
My guest today, full disclosure, old friend, hilarious guy with a great pedigree in TV who shifted to books. We're going to talk about that. He's just crushing it. Matt Goldman. Matt, how are you today?
Good, Jeff. Man, it's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. Let's take this chronologically because I'll lose my place if I don't do that.
Yeah.
You start. Did you have an eye at the beginning that you might be writing books, or was it just a path that opened up for you as life presented itself?
No, it was always a dream, a hope. Yeah. I always hope to get that way to that place. I'm a late bloomer in everything I do. And, I didn't see stand up as a stepping stone to that. I saw stand up just as stand up. And one thing just led to another. You know, I did stand up. I enjoyed it, but I loved the writing part way more than the performing part.
Right.
And I just kind of partially with on your counsel moved to Los Angeles with a dented up Ford Escort in 1987 and found my way into the TV writing business. And, you know, in the TV writing business, they pay you. So I stuck around a while.
Yeah, that's a good stand up a little less so.
A little less so and more so than the book world, at least for most of us. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so you're starting a stand-up. You start in Minneapolis. Clearly, your writing's top caliber. A lot of guys interested, a lot of comics interested in your writing. You get to L.A. What presents itself that says, there's a little niche. Maybe I'll shoot into TV writing. What was the first gig?
Well, there were a couple of little gigs that some mutual friends of ours, agents, pocket cliented me, which means I wasn't officially signed to the agency, but they heard of some work and they connected me with the producers and it worked out. Little things like punching up jokes on game shows and things like that.
Right,
but my first big break was Seinfeld.
And you how'd know, you slide it? Yeah. What did he see work? Did he?
Well, when I lived in Minneapolis, I opened for Jerry at the Comedy Gallery. 10 shows in 1 week. You know, this is pre-Seinfeld, the show. So he was far from being a household name, but he was known in the stand-up world from his appearances on The Tonight Show and Letterman.
Right.
And 10 sold-out shows in 1 week, and we became friends. And then I wrote a play with Pat Hazel that Jerry really liked, called Bunk Bed Brothers. And
Now that was two brothers move back home or visit back home?
Two brothers return to their childhood home to celebrate their parents' 25th anniversary. And the house is full of relatives, so they have to share their old bedroom, which has half been turned into a sewing room. And their dad says, listen, all this stuff, take what you want with you. The rest of it's going to the Goodwill. It's a two-act play. It's before they go to the anniversary party and when they come back. And they're going through their stuff. And it's really about their relationship. That's what drives the thing. But it's just a bunch of jokes. It's two stand-ups. Right.
An honest writer.
Yeah.
It's just a bunch of jokes. There's some emotional underpinning, but pretty much.
It's
we're selling tickets on the jokes.
Yeah. We went and bought, we went to thrift stores and found all our old toys, like the Visible Man, the Clear Guy, and Nerf guns and everything we had when we were little. And we just wrote jokes about them. And you know, that play ran in several cities. It got great reviews.
Yeah.
Film deal with Sony TriStar out of it. When that fell apart, we got a TV deal with NBC. Yeah.
So that gives you a little bit of scaffolding on which to then go to Seinfeld as he's starting up, whatnot, and something works out.
Yeah. You know, I mean, Pat, who I wrote the play with was, and still is a stand-up, and the Seinfeld Chronicles had those stand-up interstitials, and Pat would go work with Jerry to work out those stand-up bits, and I focused more on script writing. And then I was in the TV writing club after that. So once you're in, you're in for a while anyway.
Yeah. you got a solid 8 years exclusivity.
Yeah. Well, yes, you do.
Before you're on the trading block.
Yeah. It's like winning the Masters. You're just in for a while. After
right.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. You got a 10-year exemption card, but then.
Yeah.
Yeah. The injured reserve list.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, brother. Hey, guys, that was sponsored by the Dollar Confederate Statue Store. Oh, that's nice to know, Chet. Thank you. Has it come full circle for you? Does because now you've got the books, you've got a series of books, and really you're shot out of a cannon here. The first one's published in 2017. Mm-hmm. These are all featuring a private investigator named Nils Shapiro.
Yeah.
Which I'm guessing is a combination of the fact that you grew up in Minnesota, so you have the Scandinavian, and then you have the Jewish last name.
Yeah, I am actually named after a Swedish immigrant, and so I wanted to do that for Nils, and it's not so obvious with a name like Matt. So I went through my Swedish friends' names. You know, in Minnesota, like my books, when my editors sent them out for foreign publication, both Sweden and Norway passed because they said my books were too Scandinavian. You know, I am not Scandinavian. I've never been to Scandinavia, but I just wrote about Minnesota. Fortunately, Sweden has changed their mind, and now the books are published there. Which
have they been to Solvang and places like that? Do they understand more Swedish is better Swedish? Do they not?
I don't know. And the Swedes and the Norwegians are like the kings of noir. You know, Scandinavian noir is it. So I'm happy to be included in their little collection. Yeah.
Oh, so maybe they were just vetting you. until the reviews came in and they said, all right, he's cool enough to have an obscure show written on some streaming platform about us.
So the first four books are a private detective. The first three set in Minnesota. The last one, the fourth, he goes to LA.
Now, we're going to dive in on that a little bit, but when in the TV world did you say, I'm out?
You know, what happened was 16, 17, 18 years ago, TV got really good with The Sopranos and The Wire.
Right.
Breaking Bad, House of Cards.
Homicide.
Network TV. Yeah. Homicide, The Good Wife. I mean, it got great, but they were all dramas. Yeah. But it changed the landscape of Hollywood. You know, it had always been, you want to work in film, and if you can't work in film, work in TV.
Right.
But those shows changed that because there wasn't good character work in film anymore because of the dynamics of that industry. So, but then TV tried to be cool. TV comedy tried to be cool. And, you know, comedy, we know is not cool.
It should never try to be cool.
No. You know, like Ralph Cramden, not a cool guy, and Lucille Ball, and Fraser Crane, and George Costanza, they're idiots. They're morons. But we like them because they represent that part of ourselves. But when they tried to make TV cool, and there were some great shows like 30 Rock, but they're really great writing, really great actors, great joke writing. But to me, they weren't very compelling on a human level.
Right.
And so I started to lose interest and thought maybe I should be writing drama. That's what I'm mostly watching. And I started reading crime fiction to do my research. And I've always been a big reader, but never crime fiction. I'd see people carrying those books at the airport. I call them big font books, like the Da Vinci Code and Gone Girl. And I'm like, whoa, I think I'm too highbrow for that. Meanwhile, I'm running sitcoms. You know, I don't know where that came from. But
sure. Yeah.
So, but then I fell in love.
The bar looks higher when you're staring up at it from this close. You know, it's like, oh, sitcoms. Yeah. And then you look over there and you go, hey, who's that author with his name and giant bold type on the front of the book? What's the title? Forget it.
Yeah, exactly. But then I found this thing in crime fiction, which is like when you have a crime at the center of your story, dead body, clues coming along, phone rings. Hey, we got the prints off the gun. It really frees up some time for your characters to be people, and you can just focus on their lives and their relationships.
Right. So a strong central engine sort of took some of the weight off of perhaps the story element of
it did. The characters didn't have to carry the whole weight of the story.
Right, right.
Stuff was happening around them. And so I just kind of fell in love with it. And I had like a 3-month window. I was splitting my time between Minneapolis and LA. I knew I was going to go work on a show in May. It was January, colder than hell. And both of my kids had just gone back for their second semesters of college. And I just sat down and I wrote Gone to Dust, the first book.
Wow. How long did it take you?
3.5 months.
Jeez, that's, I would think, pretty fast.
It is in the book world, but if you combine a TV writer's work ethic with a Midwestern work ethic,
right,
and not being good at anything else in life, it's a.
I let's such find a better spin. Laser focused. How's that?
Laser focused. Yes, thank you.
You spit it out in 3.5 months. Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah, yeah. And then I didn't tell my Hollywood agents because I thought somehow they'll put their stink on it. You know, they'll try to make it a TV show before it's a book, which I've seen happen several times author friends. And then I just blind queried agents in New York and I found a great one. And my fifth book, which is not a Nils book, is coming out in May.
Yeah. With a more Italian first name, Joey. I believe
Joey. That's right. Joey Green.
Yeah.
Not Italian, but close.
You're inching your way.
Yeah.
Towards a full blown mob book.
Yeah.
So now you got 4 successful books. They're rave reviews. Neil Shapiro getting a lot of cred for, as you might expect, but still tough to deliver, I would think, on the page, especially in a book, snappy repartee. You know, we tend to lose that, I think, in a lot of modern crime drama. You know, I go back and I look at The Thin Man. You know, I look at some of those great 40s and 50s, even Maltese Falcon. You look at some of the dialogue between Sidney Greenstreet, you know, and everybody, literally, is just razor sharp and funny, despite some very serious underpinnings. You seem to have revived a little bit of that. I know Carl Hyacin and people like that have certainly, you know, specialized in that, but it's nice to see it coming back again in a strong form. That seems to be a lot of the cred that the books are getting is based on a strong central character that people just want to see more and more of.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. I don't think there's drama if there's not comedy. Shows and books that are just so heavy and you know, it's just human nature to find humor in a dark situation. You know, in the TV world, The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, they're hilarious, those shows.
Well, I just remember in the year I spent at Larry Sanders, Gary Shandling wrote on a sort of a dramatic platform.
Yeah.
He wrote essentially drama. What are these people looking for? Why do they want it now? What is their selfish agenda? You know, and then you throw that in a room and suddenly you're like, oh, I don't have to work on the machinations of this. I can just go, why does Hank want to get out of the room so fast? He's got an orange juice commercial. You know what I mean?
So
that was such a, and not a lot of sitcoms are written like that. So it was really gratifying to learn that, even though I couldn't apply it to any other sitcom, but just from a story standpoint, the humor will come out. Gary always said the humor is going to come out, but write it like a drama with some hits and some emotions and then go to the comedic element of the emotion.
Yes.
And I think you're right. I think humans do that to survive horrible situations.
Yeah. And it's what made Seinfeld work, at least when Larry David was there. People say that show is about nothing. It was about selfishness.
Yeah, it's about nothing being the most important thing in their world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's about something.
And it is. And then we all have those, you know, we've all left a message for somebody that we regretted. We've all had a boss we hated. We all wanted to do something terrible to that boss. Most of us are human beings and don't do it. But on Seinfeld, they did it, which is what right. made it funny. But it always started in a very real place. You're about to make love to a beautiful woman, but you really have to take a dump and the bathroom's right next to the bedroom. So you just
right.
leave. You know? Exactly. Those are very real situations. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember Jerry once saying, because he was so frustrated, you know, the show was so successful and it really, and had come into the television world through sort of a side door, through a late night deal where they split mm-hmm. up a 2-hour special into 4 half-hours. And Jerry really pushed for that. And then it became this massive hit, probably the biggest sitcom of the modern era, without a doubt. And he had sort of clearly laid out a new template.
Yes.
And then I remember talking to him once. He was so frustrated because he said, like, nobody followed it. You know,
no,
went back to writing, you know,
however they used to sort of approach. 100% correct, because yeah. people remember, oh, there's these huge stories where each character has their own story and then they dovetail in some crazy way at the end of the story. And it's crazy, but no one remembers how that show started. Four
right.
characters looking for a car in a parking garage. That was the whole episode.
Right.
Four characters sitting at a table waiting for in a Chinese restaurant, waiting for a table. That's how that you not until you got to know those characters and know them well, could one lie to a woman and say he's a marine biologist and another one hit a golf ball into the ocean that lands in a whale spout and the whale washes up on shore and somebody says, "Is a marine biologist here?" Like, you can't yeah. start in that place. You have
yeah,
to
right, right.
earn your way. You have to earn it. You have to get there one season at a time.
Yeah, just human nature. I think Better Things, Pamela Adlon's show, is a great example of someone picking up that mantle, taking the baton, and really continuing mm-hmm. with it. So you're approaching the plot lines of your books that way, with some real hardcore human nature pain.
Yeah,
and
I write completely inside out.
Up.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I don't outline. I don't. It surprises a lot of people, but a lot of mystery and thriller writers don't outline.
Why is that?
I think, well, I've written on over 500 episodes of TV. Every one has gone through an outline process.
If for no other reason then you're tired as shit of outlines. That's
well,
a good enough reason at that point.
You've been in that room. I mean, yeah. you'll go through 3 or 4 drafts of an outline before the writer's room is happy with it. Then you send yeah. it to the studio and you go through another 3 or 4 drafts. Then you send it to the network and you do it all over again. And then you get this outline that supposedly 200 people think is fantastic. And the writer writes the script based on the outline. Script sucks. Because the characters are not up on their feet. They're not
yeah.
creating story from the inside out. You think
right.
of this story using the same part of your brain with which you make a shopping list. And then you try to hammer those characters into place to make them fit. And
into
then
the shopping, yeah.
their truth falls away.
Yeah.
So their reality goes away. Yeah.
So you will start with a character and let him or her dictate
yeah.
to you what happens next.
Yeah, or I'll start with one situation, put my characters in it in motion, let them react honestly, and that generates story.
So there may be some tools though from stand-up and sitcom writing that cross over into the novel toolkit.
Almost all of them.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, I'd always been a big reader and I'd always paid attention to prose. I'm an embarrassingly slow reader. I always have been because I'm always looking at sentence structure and where people put commas and don't put commas. And
yeah.
And so that part you don't learn if you read a TV or film script or a transcript of what a stand-up says. You're not learning how to write prose other than brevity, you know, the
right.
value of brevity,
Right.
Not using words where you don't need them. And, but character development, relationship arcs, story structure, series arcs, all of it comes from both stand-up and television writing.
You mentioned an interesting thing earlier about blind submitting to book agents.
Mm-hmm.
Or as they're called, I believe, literary agents. Why don't I have a fact checker? I don't have a fact checker. I'm just in my office. I got nobody.
They are called the cats. Yeah.
So did you literally just look them up and hit them up blind with a resume on top of a manuscript, a resume of your TV work on top of your
podcast? There's a process. Fortunately, the internet has helped. I didn't have to lick envelopes, but I looked up like who represents in the mystery genre.
Right.
And I sent them what's called a query letter. Hey, I wrote this book. It's so many words. This is a brief description. And here's a little bit about me.
Right.
And would you like to see any of it? And some would say yes, some would say no. And then I'd send off three chapters or so to those who wanted to see it. And some would want to see the entire book and some wouldn't. And there were a few who were interested. It's the crazy thing about the book world is no matter how successful of an author you hear about, they have a million rejection letters sitting in their file cabinet, whether it's J.K. Rowling or Stephen King, or it's right. just a process till you find the person who's passionate about you, and then once you get out there, once your books are out there, I'm traditionally published, so I have some marketing behind me, which helps. But there's trade journals with the libraries and in the publishing industry, and it's a very slow word of mouth build kind of thing.
So to build your brand in that world takes a little more time.
It does, not for everybody. Some people have a bestseller right out of the gate, but most of the people, especially in the crime fiction world, Michael Connelly, it didn't happen until the sixth book. I think Stephen King hit it right out of the gate with Carrie was his first book.
Here's what I'm gonna just hire a fact checker. I can't think of it. Between you and me, some kid is getting a job from UCLA.
Stuff. Yeah. None of it's true.
No.
Yeah. No, but yeah, that's, I mean.
And is that daunting at some point? You've got to look at the private investigator crime mystery genre and just go, killer author, oh, she's good, killer author, unbelievable killer author. And that whole shelf is, I mean, it's,
yeah,
there's a lot of good writing in that genre.
Yeah, and I chose that genre because I could take my decades of comedy writing experience, put it in the voice of my narrator,
and
then tell a serious story.
So way you may have an edge in the sense that you've got some uniqueness to a central character that maybe other writers can't bring.
A Jewish PI in Minnesota around a bunch of Scandinavians. So, I mean, I have my own niche in that way, but clearly some of the books you mentioned, the authors Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, huge influences on me.
Right.
Yeah. And now I'm moving out of the PI genre and into standalone books.
Right. Man, that twist sponsored by Nugentix. Wiener pills directly from Ted Nugent and JCPenney, dressing homicide detectives for over 60 years. Back to you, Jeff. So these book tours, you have to go on a book tour soon.
Yeah.
Is this anything like the road for stand-up?
No.
Nothing.
Not
even good liquor. It sounds like
there's
it was so
liquor.
Quick. Oh, they're okay.
Well, of what I remember, because I did stand-up a long time ago, what I remember of the road was you walk around a shopping mall all day. You're killing time. You're trying to work. You're usually not in the most ideal working situation. You're in a club condo or a Holiday Inn or something. It's horrible. And then you go to the show and you stand around a lot and you get up and do your thing and you wait till everybody's done. Then you go out and eat ribs and then you go home and sleep till noon and then you go to the mall again.
It's predictable.
The book world is you go to a bookstore, there's people who really want to see you. You know, you don't get heckled at book signings. And then you go out for a nice dinner and then you go to the next town. Yeah.
That's now how long is it? How long is it? Like
they're,
how many
they're
cities?
Not very long. This one I'll do several cities in the Midwest and then I'll go down to South Carolina and do a few there. And then I'll go to LA and Phoenix and do some there.
Has it come full circle? Is Hollywood now interested in doing a Nils Shapiro a la Fletch? Is anybody sniffing around going, hey, maybe there's a series of, or a TV show or a streaming series or something?
Yeah, it comes up once in a while. I hear things, you know, I know way more about that.
You're not privy to them, but you hear.
No, they say, hey, people are talking. People want, you know, free options and things like that.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, let me know what you want to do. But it's, I know so much more about that business still.
Yeah.
The show business than the book business, even though my fifth book's coming out, that I just don't hold my breath for that at all.
Yeah.
You know, I have plenty of author friends who get optioned and they're all excited. And I'm like, just settle down. You know, the chances of something becoming a show is so slim. So we'll see. I mean, it's interesting. PI stories do not have a lot of traction in the States. They do way more in Europe for some reason. And, you know, I thought it might change because there used to be a lot of cop shows in the 60s here.
Right.
And then Vietnam happened. And then you want a more counterculture figure out investing your crimes. And then you have Rockford.
Right.
And, you know, you get that kind of thing. And PI took off. And then 9/11 happened. And people want the men and women in blue again.
Right.
And I always thought it would flip back, but it hasn't yet.
Not yet. Right.
No.
But I think it will. I think it's always a pendulum. Now, but first of all, because I just came up with two thoughts and I'll lose them both because I'm 103 years old. I better blurt them out. I've already lost it. Just talking about, no, wait a second. Was there a thought in the back of your head ever when you were in television or in the business out here where you saw at least partially some writing on the wall and said, you know, maybe it's time to move into books because of streaming services, even though there's a lot of good drama out there. But as you pointed out, they tend to be dramas, not sort of human interest dramas, not a lot of humor in them. Was there ever a time creatively or even from the cold, hard facts of the business going, I'm white, I'm getting older. Let me get, you know, maybe it's time to pursue this other dream I have.
Well, for me, it, you know, if you ever look at the odds of making it, you would never even start. So I tried not to look at those business factors as much. For me, it was more about my personality. I mean, I'm super introverted. I'm an introvert with social skills is what I am. But being in a room full of writers and other production people for 60, 70, 80 hours a week was exhausting for me.
Yeah.
And I always wanted more of a work by myself situation just to fit my personality.
Sure.
And book writing offered that for me. I mean, I love my days where I'm just writing books. So it was always a hope. No medium is better than any other medium, but I always was touched most by books and hope to be able to write a book someday. And so it was more about that. I always tried to not think of the business dynamics going around me because I was afraid I would just quit.
Yeah.
If I did. Because it's so daunting.
Point. Yeah. To trust a more accurate compass is probably wise. And your your internal compass is always going to be the most accurate. Your creative compass is going to be the one that pushes you in the right way. Man, that little interchange sponsored by Rocket City, the JetBlue of space travel. And of course, River Glance, the Irish dance sensation where only their eyes move. All right, a couple of quick tips.
Man, I missed Chet.
before we shuffle off. On your journeys on these book tours and from your days on the road, do you have a worst gig? Or it could be TV too, but because you just mentioned 70, 80 hours a week in a room with the same people for, you know, sometimes several years in a row.
Yeah.
You know, when you think of all the jobs you've done, and it sounds like this probably won't qualify because you're on your own and you're not self-loathing. So I can't imagine you have too brutal of a day.
Oh, I'm self-loathing.
All right. Hold on there, pal.
I have my comedian card.
That's great. What's a gig that stands out in your mind and you just go, oof?
You know, this gig wasn't as horrible for me as it was for the audience. It's one of my favorite things ever, and it goes all the way back to stand-up. There's a local stand-up and promoter who sadly we lost recently in the Twin Cities named Scott Hansen. And Scott put together a show called The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. And it was three comedians on the road. And I don't know who was the good and the bad and the ugly, but the three comedians were me, a very nice man and perfectly funny guy named Tom Baumgartner.
Sure.
And a guy many of your audience will know named Tom Arnold. And Tom Arnold was not famous yet.
Right.
He was not nationally famous or even locally famous at that point. But Scott would send us out to smaller cities like Mankato, Minnesota, and Rochester, Minnesota, where all they knew of stand-up was The Tonight Show. And they were basically afraid. Everybody was these nice Minnesotans. They were afraid of nightclubs. And they went into these shows scared to death. Scared to death. And I would go up first. And, you know, when I was 25, I was younger then. I was 22. I looked about 14.
Yes, and that's true.
So, and I had a very clean act. And they'd see me and they'd go, oh, this is a very nice boy. He's okay. And then Tom Baumgartner would go up and do jokes about selling insurance, which was his day job. And they'd say, right. Oh, he seems like a perfectly reasonable young man. and the audience would relax. And they would basically
take off
their shells, their armor, their Minnesota stoic Scandinavian guard. They would let it all down. And then Tom Arnold would go up there and eviscerate them. And to the point where people were leaving in droves. And every time it was great fun for me to watch. It was horrible for the audience, though. It was a really cruel thing.
Oh, yeah. And I'm sure that's like at a Budgetel banquet hall. You know, they're never official clubs or rooms.
No, they were never official clubs. They were like the Mississippi room at the Sheridan.
And Arnold, was he doing the Goldfish Act at the time?
He was doing the Goldfish Act then. He was,
which I will admit, I loved. I got to admit.
Tom is a great comedian and a very nice man. In those days, he was not on his best behavior.
No, but hugely funny instincts. And when he wants to eviscerate someone, it's you don't really stand a chance. Professionals, perhaps. Stand a chance, but a civilian, there's, you know, you're not matching wits with Tom Arnold. He'll beat you every time.
No, every time. And I had a ton, you know, we all had terrible road gigs then.
But still, that's
To
just think of people talking for weeks about a guy who put two goldfish in plastic.
My mother for her 70th birthday, and he made a reference to sleeping with her. That is not okay.
That's great. Awesome. Any travel tips you have? Because you're still on the road. Look at you. Started as a stand-up, going to Mankato.
I know. I'm
Rochester.
Going back out. I'm still looking for the perfect device charger, like one thing that can charge everything.
Yeah.
The phone, the Apple Watch, the computer, the headphones. I just want there to be, there should be like a sphere of electricity that you can just open it up, put your crap in, shut it, and it just charges.
Sure. Put that on the desk in the hotel room instead of seven different brands of tea that you're never going to brew because everything tastes like coffee coming out of that freaking pot. So nobody's brewing anything in their room. They can go downstairs now and get a cup of coffee for free.
Yeah.
So put the sphere of energy.
The sphere of energy that your stuff can go into.
Then you can play basketball and you just take
your
iPhone.
Yeah, there you go.
Try to get it in for nothing. Matt, thank you so much. This was a blast. My guest today, folks, the talented Matt Goldman. Here are the books that he has written that he'll tell you how to find them and everything. But Gone to Dust, featuring these four, I believe, feature Nils Shapiro. Great, great, great character for a private eye. Gone to Dust, Dead West, The Shallows, and Broken Ice. And then you're branching out and you're a standalone book, a Carolina Moonset. Is that it?
Correct. That is it.
That's got to be, I would think, in the world you're in, a bit daunting too. So you're on a nice big ice flow. That's these PI books. And now you're getting in a groove. And then all of a sudden it's like, oops, I got to step over to this little ice flow over here and see if I can float on that.
Yeah, I like that. I like the change, new characters, new, you know, only so many people want to read PI books. And this is more of a family mystery, family drama. Yeah.
Family drama. So you walked on water over to the next ice flow. Well, I had such a nice analogy built there. And I just went,
if there's ice, it all works. Yeah,
sure. You're in Minnesota. Why not, Matt? Where do we find you? Facebook or Twitter or?
I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm at mattgoldman.com. My books are available, many independent bookstores, Barnes and Noble, Amazon, all over the place. Yeah,
that's fantastic. And is it mattgoldman.com? Is that a central sort of clearinghouse for some of this stuff? Or is the publisher is it your Facebook page?
The publisher, if you go to Macmillan's website, there you can get the books through there as well.
Yeah. And a good geography book from 1973, Macmillan's.
There you go.
I'm not mistaken. Matt, thank you so much. This was
amazing. Hey, great. Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Follow me on Twitter at Real Jeff Cesario. My album, What Was I Thinking? This guy's writing books. I managed to crank out one album in the last 15, 17 years. But no, it's new. Streaming everywhere. Actually, I recorded it at Acme in Minneapolis. We had a great time.
I love that club.
Yeah. The Play With Pain mugs are available at jeffcesario.com. And I'm so close, everybody, to getting a check from Cafe Press. They keep most of the money. And then they don't pay until your $1.25 per mug adds up to, $7,000 or whatever. I don't know what the minimum is, but I need a check is what I'm saying. So if you're in the mood for a Father's Day gift or a Mother's Day gift, it's a great gift because it's just a mug. Comes in a box, slap a bow on it, you're done. So go to jeffcesario.com. You'll find those there. Look for me, hopefully soon on the road. I'm going to post some tour dates and get back out there. Why not? And probably return to Minneapolis. Speaking of Acme Comedy Club. So do all of that, folks. And of course, you can find Matt everywhere on Facebook. Go to Macmillan's page and you'll find all his books there. They're tremendous. You got to do it. Read more. Chet, what do you got cooking? Oh, this weekend I'll be in Mount McCracken, Wyoming, calling the 13th annual Drunk Giant Slalom for SkiLarious.com. First one down the hill wins, dead or alive. Sponsored by Tempura Pedic, the lightly fried adjustable mattress, and My Pillow Case. Make any pillow your pillow with My Pillow Case. This is Chet Waterhouse reminding you to play with pain.